Welcome to the Volcast podcast. I'm Ruth. I run the Climate Action Hub here at WDCVS. And our guest today is...
My name's Andrew Williams, and I'm the local program manager for Virtue.
Thank you so much for coming along and chatting to us today, Andrew. So to begin with, could you tell us a little bit about Virtue? Who are you? What do you do? And why does the things that Virtue do, why does that matter?
Yeah, well, thanks very much for having me, Ruth. It's fantastic to be here today. Virtue is Scotland's climate resilience charity, and we're one of the few organisations in Scotland who really focus on resilience and adaptation when it comes to issues around climate. And what that means is basically that we have a focus on how our communities and our neighbourhoods are going to change in the years ahead of us as we get to grips with and as we adapt to the changing climate that we can see around us. Virtue has been around for about 30 years. We were previously called SNFR for very unusual reasons, but SNFR actually stood for the Scotland and Northern Ireland Forum for Environmental Research. So it just goes to show there's an acronym for everything. but now we've just launched our new strategy based on just resilience, and we work across Scotland. And as I say, we're trying to really focus on building from the communities that we work with up to really try and help neighbourhoods, people, businesses, organisations to adapt to the changing climate that we see all around us.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Andrew. There's a lot of really interesting information in there. I think I'll begin with a question around, you know, when we talk about climate change, often the focus is on mitigating climate change, so reducing or completely eliminating our emissions. And Virtue's working on adapting to the changes of climate change. So why is adapting important, and kind of what's its role alongside mitigating emissions as well?
Yeah, and I think that the first thing to say there is that reducing our carbon emissions is hugely important. You know, there's no doubt about that. And that's definitely not something that we have an argument with or something that we're, you know, trying to play down. You know, I think everybody at Virtue is committed to doing everything that we can to help people to reduce their carbon emissions. But I think what we can see when we look around us in Scotland is that even if we were to reach net zero tomorrow or completely reduce our carbon emissions overnight, we are still going to have to deal with the effects of climate change that we can already see around us. We know that average temperatures have risen. We know that average sea temperatures have risen. And we know that we're going to feel those effects no matter what. Now, that creates risks. Obviously, it creates a lot of risks for people who are maybe dealing with the effects of climate change that they weren't expecting to. So we deal a lot with communities around the coast of Scotland who are seeing the way that their landscape looks change a lot. So there are risks that we need to help people to deal with. But there are also a lot of opportunities, I think. And this is where I think we're really able to try and put a positive spin on this as well. We don't just want our communities to adapt to kind of some kind of worst case scenario that we're all in fear of. This is an opportunity for us really to make our communities better and to improve the conditions that our neighbours, our friends, our families are living in. One of the big challenges that we see across Scotland at the moment is around cost of living. And people are really struggling with their bills. They're struggling with their putting petrol in their car. They're struggling with the cost of a food shop. Now, if we can help make their homes more efficient by insulating them better so that their energy bills are lower, we're actually tackling that cost of living crisis. If we're trying to make sure that we have an integrated public transport system so that people can get around our cities more easily, we're reducing people's transport costs. And if we can give them better and cheaper access to fresh fruit and vegetables, then there are health benefits from that, but also climate benefits from that as well. So this isn't necessarily a doom and gloom story. It is a real opportunity for us to improve the neighbourhoods and the communities that we live in across Scotland.
Yeah, I think that kind of brings it on nicely to one of the core things that Virtue aims to do, which is to bring everyone along in this just transition. That's mentioned quite a lot in the strategy that you mentioned. And you talk a lot about just resilience as well. So what does just resilience, what does a just transition mean? And why is fairness such an important part of climate adaptation?
Yeah, and I think you're right, Ruth. I think this is really something that's crucial to the way that Virtua is sort of facing the work that we're doing in the years ahead of us. And I think that one of the things that we would say, not trying to be controversial here necessarily, but I would say that if we're just looking at this through the lens of carbon reduction, then, as I say, I don't think that tells the whole story. We've just finished a 3-year project in Glasgow called Creative Climate Futures that was looking at how we could help communities adapt to the effects of climate change in the future. And we work with communities in Easterhouse and the Gorbals. And I think I would say there are communities in Easterhouse whose carbon emissions should actually be increasing. You know, they should be emitting more carbon, because at the moment there are families there, households, who are having to make a choice between whether they heat their homes or whether they buy food, whether they cook food, whether they put petrol in the car, as I say. So if we're introducing this lens of kind of fairness to what we're doing, I think that's absolutely crucial. And that allows us to see this just resilience journey that we want to be on as something that, as I say, isn't just a technical thing. It's not a spreadsheet thing about how we're reducing emissions or how we're, changing people's electricity or gas use or anything like that. It's about how we can make our communities fairer and how we can make sure that those who are often have added the least to climate change and aren't suffering the most from climate change. Something we see on a global level as well. Often countries, around the world who have contributed the least to carbon emissions are actually the countries who are suffering the most from the effects of climate change. And we see this, you know, all over the world. But at a local level as well, I think we can see that. And I think it's something that we think is hugely important to have this, a justice lens that we apply to it to make sure that it's not something where people are just being expected to pay more for things or being expected to carry the can, if you like, for the emissions that we've historically been responsible for. And as I say, I think it's something that really allows us to look at this as something that should be a positive for our neighbourhoods and our communities, something where we can use this as a way of saying that what we've done before hasn't worked for everybody. And this is an opportunity to bring those people with us and to create a fairer society, ultimately. That's what we're looking for.
So it sounds like kind of using the lens of climate adaptation and framing that in terms of what kind of society do we want to live in the future that's fair, that's equitable, and that's also resilient to the challenges we're facing already and the climate challenges that we're going to be facing more in the future as well. So do you have, you talked about the Creative Climate Futures one, you can talk more about that, but do you have either that one or any other examples of, you know, work where you have worked with communities and you have had, you know, positive resilient outcomes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's really the crucial thing here is that, you know, this, we don't want this to be just a theoretical exercise or an academic exercise. And I also don't think that we want it to be something where we're purely looking, and this is something that people think about a lot, I think, when they think about adaptation is almost, you know, engineering solutions. You know, we need higher flood protection barriers. You know, we need better, defences, if you like, to help us adapt. And that is part of it. And unfortunately, that will be a part of it for, especially for coastal communities or people who are at risk of flooding or at risk of excess heat. But I think much more important than that, around how we adapt, if you like, is to create resilient communities that feel more cohesive, that feel like they're fairer for the people who live in them and that are able to communicate with one another. I think, you know, what I would say that we've seen, you know, in Scotland over the past 30 or 40 years is an increasing division among people and an increasing isolation among households and communities, and people feeling like they're on their own and that they need to look out for number one and that they need to do what's right for them. And I think if we're going to tackle this crisis, which is going to be a huge, huge change in the way that we live our day-to-day lives, we have to bring people together more. And I think that's where resilience at a community level really, really means something to me. I would come back to this thing, the project that we worked on, Creative Climate Futures. And I think when we started working with a group in the Gorbals, who were based at Crossroads Youth and Community Association, I think they had so much pride in their local area, and they were so really pleased to live there. It wasn't somewhere that they felt was, you know, an area that was, you know, deprived in inverted commas or anything like that. It was somewhere that, that had a really proud history, and that somewhere that people were really, really pleased to call home. But I think that they had been let down, frankly, by the people who had been making decisions on their behalf. And I think what that had caused was, what that then caused was this sense of, a sense of distrust, really, between the local community and then the people like the local council, people like the local housing association, and a feeling that decisions were being made kind of without their permission, really. And I think what we tried to do with Creative Climate Futures was just instill a sense of confidence in the people who were working in that area, to give them the capacity that they needed to be able to speak to people about what they wanted their community to look like in the future, and a bit of the background information about adaptation and resilience that would allow them to explain how they saw their communities developing in the future. And I think out of everything that they did, and they did so many amazing things, there was a walking route around the Gorbals, there was an amazing wildflower meadow that looks incredible now that it's starting to, you know, to come to life, loads of local food projects, loads of local environmental projects, bee posts for bees to hibernate over the winter, all these amazing things. So that there were really tangible things. But I think the greatest thing really was something that was intangible, and that was the sense of confidence that the community had after having taken part in the project and having gone from sort of thinking that, you know, oh, we just get let down all the time. People will do what they want to do, even if we say that we don't want it to happen to our community. There's really nothing that we can do, a sense of powerlessness. Through the project, I think we managed to sort of reinstill a sense of confidence in the community and a sense that these were decisions that they should be a part of, and that their voice really needed to be at the center of decisions that were being made on their behalf. And I think that's really been the real outcome of that project, has been that sense of confidence in that community.
Yeah, that sounds really awesome. Really, really positive. So what kind of things were you doing with those communities? Was it kind of workshops? Yeah, what kind of stuff were you doing to kind of
And this was what I think made the project really interesting, was that for a long time at the start, we really didn't do anything other than listen to people. Mm. And I think that was really crucial for the project's success, because again, a lot of areas around Glasgow, around Scotland, are very used to people coming in with a clipboard and sort of saying, oh, we want to hear your views, we want to hear you, you know, what your community thinks, and then doing a little bit of research and then leaving again, you know, and nothing happening. And what we wanted to do was really understand what was making the community tick, but also understand who the people were that the communities were going to listen to. And that's what we realized very quickly was going to be the key to unlocking the potential of the area, was not us going in saying, we're the experts, we're here to tell you what to do. Those communities were already used to people going in and saying that. And it was something that there was a, you know, frankly, an understandable sense of cynicism around. What we wanted to do was go in and sort of say, right, who are the groups that these communities are listening to? Who are the groups? Maybe they're faith groups, maybe they're after school clubs, maybe they're breakfast clubs, maybe they're groups for mums and toddlers, maybe it's a men's shed. Who are the groups that these communities actually feel are a trustworthy source of information? And then once we've identified that, and this took us about 6 months, I would say, of really no activity on the ground other than listening to people, going along to meetings and chatting to people. And it was only at that point that we really started thinking about what those groups might want to do and what they might want to see. So it was a really long process of identification that, that happened first. And the key kind of tool that we had in our project to make this happen was that we had embedded artists that we were working with as part of this project. So we worked with an organisation called Culture for Climate Scotland to identify artists who would be able to go in and really embed themselves in the neighbourhoods, in the areas, to do this engagement work with the local people. And the artists weren't there just to produce pieces of work. You know, they weren't there to do murals of polar bears on the side of tenement buildings, as beautiful as that might have been. But they were there to work with the people on the ground, doing little exercises, doing little artistic, creative interventions that would then give the local people the kind of the step back from their day-to-day lives, if you like, to be able to think about what they wanted the future to look like. And I think this is a crucial thing, not just in our project, but for anybody contemplating a project like this in the future, is that 99% of the people who we need to reach as part of this just simply don't have the time to be involved with this. They're busy trying to put food on the table. They're busy running around trying to make sure that their families are cared for. And I think that the best thing that we can do for a lot of these communities is to give them that space, give them some breathing space to be able to think about how they want their communities to adapt and change in the future. Because those community voices are the ones that we have to hear if we're going to get this right, I think.
Yeah, it really kind of brings in the importance of collaboration and communication. Definitely. And kind of, yeah, bringing everyone along with you. I guess my kind of question is how, I've kind of answered my own question here, but how important is that sense of collaboration and those partnerships when it comes to climate resilience? We've talked a lot about the importance of working with community groups and local people as well, but kind of across all levels, kind of how important is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we found is that partnership working has gone from being something that's a kind of a desirable and a nice to have to something that's absolutely essential if we're going to tackle the climate crisis that we see. And the reason that I would say that is that there is an urgency, you know, to this, and it is something that we have to address quickly. And I think we can only do that by having a bit of humility about our own abilities. And that's something that I've certainly learned through this process, is that it's only by admitting that we're perhaps only a part of the solution that we can really get to that whole solution. And I think what we've got in Scotland is a real vibrant climate sector. Lots of groups who are doing amazing things in their own geographical area or across their own kind of different area of expertise. And I think we've got to work together if we're going to be able to do this in a timely way and in a way that's efficient. What we definitely don't want to see is people kind of working in their own little bubbles, in their own little silos, not speaking to other people who are maybe doing either very similar things that are then overlapping or doing really different things that would be brilliant for them to learn from. And I think that's where I see this as being a huge, again, it's a risk and an opportunity. You know, we definitely don't have the time for people to just kind of do things on their own without speaking to the broader sector within Scotland, because we need everybody to be moving in the same direction on this. But I think there's so much, you know, that we've learned from work that's going on in other areas. And I know that there'll be lots of things that, just thinking about the climate hubs, for example, there's so much that I'm sure different climate hubs could learn from each other. And that's why I think the Climate Hub programme is just so important to us, and something that we're just absolutely determined to support and to make sure that we can really build on. Because I think having this network of different hubs across Scotland who are all constituted differently and working in different ways is actually, you know, like, you know, really like a superpower that we can galvanise here. Because it's not something that we're going to see has a one-size-fits-all approach. And that's why I think it's great that the hubs aren't set up in a one-size-fits-all way, because it allows us to look at what's worked in one area with maybe a really small hub doing something at a really local level, and then try and apply that to a different area where the hubs may be constituted differently, and vice versa. So I think, yeah, that kind of partnership working is, as I say, has gone from something that's a nice to have to something that is absolutely fundamental to the work that we're doing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the impacts that we're feeling across Scotland, the climate impacts are different across different communities, and the way that those communities feel those impacts are different as well, depending on kind of, yeah, how the community is set up and the history of the community. But we've been talking a lot about adaptation and not actually talked about what are the climate impacts that we are experiencing in Scotland that we are experiencing today and experiencing in the future. So yeah, could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I mean, this is something that is an evolving area that's moving very quickly. And I think the number one thing to say that I always try and start from is that I don't mean any of this to sound alarmist. We are facing issues, serious issues, but we have got the tools to deal with them. And that's the number one thing that I think people have to remember, is that these are not insurmountable problems and we can deal with them. But I would say, just to pull two things out, is that when we looked at the Creative Climate Futures Project, the way that we chose the areas that we were going to work with was firstly looking at areas that scored on the index of multiple deprivation, but then we mapped that alongside areas that were at risk from flooding and areas that were at risk from urban heating. Flooding's an easy one to understand in Scotland, and an easy one to understand in Glasgow, for instance. So the areas that we worked with, you know, the Gorbals is right next to the River Clyde. Issues with urban flooding and issues that were not always obvious to us when we started the project. And one of the things we found was that it wasn't necessarily people's homes being flooded or people finding that their homes were getting damp or anything like that, although those were issues. One of the big things we found was that surface water flooding was causing people to not be able to access public transport. Because if you've got a bus stop that's got a massive puddle in front of it and you're stood there with your pram and a bus goes past and you get splashed, you are not going to wait at that bus stop again. And this was one of the strange things that we found, that, you know, I wouldn't have thought that it was as big an issue as we eventually found out that it was for people. And that was something where then we were able to work with Glasgow City Council with their flood management team to try and get to the bottom of some of the issues that were being caused there. That kind of localised flooding in an urban area is, of course, really different to what we're seeing in many rural areas and many coastal areas. We're doing a lot of work at the moment in the Murray Coast, which is at serious risk of coastal erosion due to rising sea levels. And what we're seeing there is the prospect of communities who've been there for many hundreds of years having to relocate. That is a serious issue which we're going to have to get to grips with over the next few years. I think the more difficult one in many ways is the effects of urban heat, because, like it or not, for the most part, if you try to speak to people about increased levels of heat in Glasgow, the response is generally, bring it on. We're very, very happy to hear that it's going to be warmer. And that's an understandable reaction. But I think what we've seen over this year, this summer, is just a taste of what we could be in for if we don't start tackling this very soon. And ultimately what it means is, even in Glasgow, you know, very sadly, people will lose their lives because of increased heat levels. And what we're seeing is, particularly in areas like the Gorbals, where there's lots of new build housing going up, is that housing is not being planned in a way that's going to be able to deal with those increased levels of heat. There's a huge amount of new concrete in Glasgow that is going to cause a lot of issues. We can deal with it. You know, we can, these are things that we can tackle by looking at where we're doing more green planting, looking at how we're ventilating those houses, looking at how we can be using, you know, things like solar, rooftop solar and things like that to try and get people's bills down. But it is something that we are going to have to address. One way that I would say of looking at this is that, for all the statistics around heat that we've had this year, wildfires that we've had this year and all the rest of it, this year, 2026, is almost certainly going to be the coldest year for the next 30 years. This year is going to be the year with the fewest wildfires for the next 30 years. And this year is probably going to be the year with the fewest extreme weather events, you know, for the next 30, 40 years. And I think we need to slightly try and shift the narrative on this, that the options are not the system that we're in or some beautiful Mediterranean future. You know, the option is the system that we're in or really, really upsetting climate issues. And I think that's why I say I'm not trying to be alarmist around that. And we do have the tools that we need to be able to deal with this. But it is something that we need people to be more aware of, mm-hmm. and people to be aware that it is something that is going to change the way they live their lives over the years to come.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of Virtue's role that you talk about. You know, it's not going to be some beautiful Mediterranean future. But by being, making sure that we are adapting to the changes, we can ensure that it does become a much more pleasant future than if we're not prepared, and if we don't ensure that our houses are able to deal with the heat and that our transport systems are able to deal with the flooding and things like that. And that's, yeah, where you guys come in to make sure that, yeah, the future is as livable and as enjoyable and as resilient as possible. So thank you very much for your work.
And I think that's what's really so important about this new strategy that we've just launched this year at Virtua, all around just resilience. And I think, just to take it back to what we were talking about earlier, this is about fairness. It's about equity for people. And I think, you know, we can see that in Glasgow. If you've got a very nice, you know, big house that's got a leafy garden in it where you can go out and enjoy the shade during the summer months, you know, this might not be something that's high on your agenda. But if you're, you know, on the fourth floor of a tower block where the sun is beating in every day and, you know, the idea of affording air conditioning, you know, is just a dream for you, then there's an unfairness there that we have to tackle. And I think this is where it's really important that I think Virtua thinks it's really important, and this is something that I have seen for myself through the projects that we've been working on, that it has to be something where we bring the majority of people with us. If we get into a situation where this is something that's just a kind of a middle class hobby, if you like, then we will not have succeeded in doing this. This has to be something where people who are on lower incomes, people who are from marginalized communities who are more difficult to reach, they have to be protected as well from the effects that we're going to see of the climate change that we can already see happening this year, certainly. And I think if we can move to that kind of position where people see that it's improving their lives, that the changes that are being made are having improvement to their communities, improving their housing, improving their bills. Frankly, I think it's got to involve people's bills going down, and that's something that we know can happen if we switch to renewables more quickly than we are at the moment. Then I think we can bring people with us. I think everybody across Glasgow, across Scotland, wants their communities to be better for their kids and their grandkids than they were for them growing up. They want to see life improving. And I think that's maybe not something that people have seen a lot of over the past, 20, 30 years. And I think this is a bit of a fork in the road. It could be that the climate crisis exacerbates the inequality that we see in our society. But what I hope, and what I think Virtua is trying to do, is to use the changes that we know will have to happen to our communities as a tool, as a lever to improve those communities and those neighbourhoods, so that they're more resilient in the future, so that they're shockproof from the impacts of the climate change that we know that we're going to see, and that they're better places for people to live. And I think if we do that, you know, we'll be able to look back with pride on the work that we've done, because we will know that we've actually had a really positive effect on the communities that we've been working in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and I'll be cheering along.
Well, thank you, Ruth. That's much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming along, Andrew.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.